Welcome to the last session of day two of the Microsoft Project Conference. Tomorrow, of course, we've got another fun-filled half day. What y'all learned so far? Small group. It's going to be more interactive. Still assimilating. Anyone go to Brian and Adrian's little chalk talk thing just now? It's pretty good. They talked about all sorts of bugs and stuff like that. I heard the Qualcomm presentation was pretty good. Yeah. I heard there were lots of macros and stuff. I'll have to catch that on reruns. Anyone catch the, yes?
Ben Howard's desktop, Microsoft Project desktop reporting thing.
The Ben Howard desktop reporting thing. I was kind of curious how one could talk for an hour on desktop reporting, but he pulled it off, so I was duly impressed. All right, so there's been a lot of good sessions. There's more sessions tomorrow. Anyone go to my BI session today? One, okay, so this will not be quite the same thing that we were doing there. All right. So my goal today is the epistemological adventure. It's best practices in enterprise tool deployments. So this is me saying, hey, look, you know, I've done this at least three or four times, kind of figured out what seems to work for me, what doesn't work, honestly. And this is the latest evolution of my thinking. I'm not saying it's the correct thinking, but it's the latest evolution, and it's good enough for now. My name's Andrew Levinsky. You all probably figured that one out. And I'm a vice president with UMT. So let me ask you this. What kind of challenges do you all have in deploying enterprise tools, project management tools specifically, project server probably, since that's the conference we're at? Anyone ever have any challenges with it? What? Never. Right? It's easy. You know, you go in there, and I typically say that portfolio management is a simple three-step process, right? Step one, you figure out all your projects and figure out what the work estimates are for each of those projects. Put them all in one place. It's pretty easy, right? Step two, you figure out how many resources you got. Step three, you figure out how you make decisions, and you turn that into some set of rules on a spreadsheet. You're done, right? Should take, what, 2 or 3 weeks, something like that? So how come, why does it take longer than 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, months, years to kind of reach maturity in project server and EPM tools, project management tools? Would anyone like to venture a guess?
They don't know the answer to
this. They don't know, who doesn't know? The client does not know the answer to the question. And just show of hands, how many of you are on the consulting side of the fence and on the actual client victim side of the fence? Okay, good. So we got a nice spread. They don't know, right? Well, sometimes we don't even know what we're asking. Sometimes we don't even know what question we should be asking. So the way I see this is deploying an enterprise project management tool is often, it's a journey of discovery. It's an epistemological adventure. So great. So let's kind of move through this. I've got a real simple agenda that I will cover, and I, as I've said before, I don't believe that I will take all 75 minutes unless we do. Might get, you know, very conversational, and that's fine. But we have our first option. We're going to talk about things that we think we know, but we really don't. We're going to talk about stupid organizations, and then we're going to talk about how to structure an engagement for success. That's the goal. Cover those three topics. As we covered, my name's Andrew Levinsky. I've got Twitter, I've got the blog URL. A lot of this stuff is actually pulled from blog posts that I've written over the years. Feel free to correspond with me, et cetera, and we'll move on. I am with UMT, otherwise known as UMT. Oh, Tom, hey, welcome. Tried to wait for you, they wouldn't let me, man. Sorry. All right, so I'm with UMT. Come to our many presentations at this conference. We've got a number of clients talking, and that's good. Now, I wanted to take a moment here, Nathan. I wanted to take a moment here to reflect on the holiday that is today. So first off, what is the holiday that is today? Say again? Not Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day was Sunday. Well, there was a major holiday over the weekend. No, it's not St. Crispin's Day. That's when I do my Shakespearean speech, you know, from Henry V. No, it was Lunar New Year, of course, on Friday, right? And everyone's going, ah, which means that today is, of course, day 5 of the Lunar New Year, the year of the wooden horse. Now, for those of you who probably have read the blog, you're familiar with kind of my bio. I actually, believe it or not, did not study project management in college. I was actually a Chinese major in college. And I spent a little over a year studying Chinese in Beijing in the mid-90s or so. And I just wanted to take this moment to really reflect on that and to share a story with you that I think is near and dear to my heart. So anyways, when I was studying in Beijing, I used to go off backpacking around China. I don't know if anyone's ever backpacked through China, but it's a wonderful place to backpack. You know, it's a huge country, there's a lot of stuff to see, a lot of different cultures. And my favorite place to go backpacking was the hills of like Western Sichuan. So basically you could start in Chengdu, you can hop on the road, and if you head west far enough, you'll end up in Lhasa. And there are some great villages up in the mountains there, and you would take a local bus from one village to another. And the problem was that I was on a student stipend at the time, so a Chinese government stipend, equivalent to roughly about 100 bucks a month. So I would get to this village, and I wouldn't have a lot of money to buy food. And so I kind of figured out this kind of trick is the right word, con might be a word someone might use, where basically I had the stone in my backpack. I think Tom has heard this story. I had the stone in my backpack, and I would go up to the first peasant I saw, and I'd say, hey, buddy, in Chinese, I've got this magic stone. And if you put it in a boiling pot of water, it's going to make the most delicious soup you have ever had. And of course, we'd throw a pot of water on the stove, and we'd start boiling, and we'd put the stone in, and we'd taste it. And of course, it tasted like water, right? We say, ah, well, maybe we need a couple ingredients. Let's go get maybe some chicken. So we go butcher a chicken, we boil it up, it needs a little salt, right? And then we get some vegetables, we throw some vegetables in. Soon all the neighbors are coming over with ingredients, they're throwing it all in the pot. And then pretty much we have a pretty good soup. And it's in Sichuan, right? So you got to throw in all the seasonings, the hot spice, the peppercorns. And of course, does anyone know the best ingredient that you put in a soup in Western Sichuan? No? Dried opium? Yes, makes the soup extra delicious once you put that in. So anyways, then we got this great soup, and life was wonderful, right? Did the stone actually create the soup? No, of course not. The stone was the catalyst to making the soup. So when I look at Project Server, pretty much the same thing. No, I never really did the magic stone thing. I wish I'd tried, then it would be a really cool story. I read that in a fairy tale somewhere. But the idea is the same. Project Server is that catalyst. When you walk into an organization and you are trying to, quote unquote, implement Project Server, really what we're doing is we're providing a catalyst that's the impetus for people to bring all those other ingredients. And if we're successful, everyone says, hey, look, Project Server, it's great, it's successful. But the reality is that it wasn't Project Server, it's all the other stuff that happened around it that underpinned the enterprise project management journey. So that goes back to our definition of success. So there are many opportunities for failure in a project management implementation, but there's really only a few ideas of success. And what I would say my definition of success is it's only successful if they use it. Right? If they're not using it, you kind of wasted your time. So that leads me to conclude that there is an epistemological adventure that we go on. And as some, for those of you who have read my blog, you know that's the title of the blog. And for those of you not familiar with epistemology, it's basically the study of knowledge. It's how do we know what we know, and how do we know what we not know? It's how do we define the boundaries of what we know? So let's walk through that. Let's walk through what that means. Okay, is anyone in the room a pilot, a licensed pilot, or knows how to fly a plane? Okay, so, wow, 2 out of 20, I'm very impressed. You both are exempt from answering this next question or the next set of questions. So, for those of you who are not pilots, what do you need to know to be a pilot? Just shout out some answers, shout out some ideas. You need to know how to actually fly a plane. That would be good, generally. What else? How to navigate. What else? Say again, how to read instruments, do instrumentation. What else? How to turn on the autopilot. What else? Say again? You need a plane, but let's talk about knowledge. What do I need to know? I need to know how to use a plane, what about specifics of a plane. Dale?
Know why?
I need to know physics. I need to know what's the physics behind it. Probably I need to know something about weather, maybe meteorology, how it might impact the plane. But really, for those of us who are not pilots in the room, where we are is we're at the stage of unconscious incompetence. So what that means is we don't know stuff, and we're not even sure what we don't know. We're taking a guess here, right? The next stage would be conscious incompetence. So for me, that would mean I go out, I buy a book on how to fly a plane, and I read it, and I'm probably still missing a whole slew of things. But at this point, I at least know what I don't know, right? In a project management world, what I typically talk about, and I've got a couple blog posts about this, is when you walk into an organization and they say, hey, look, we've got this entire scheduling process down. I say, great, you know, what's your project update methodology? Oh, well, we don't really have one. Well, you kind of need one of those to develop some sort of standardized reporting. So conscious incompetence is sitting down and realizing, hey, here's the stuff we don't actually know, which is the first step to actually figuring out what it is that we need to know, or what it is that we should know. All right, so we're going to switch metaphors here. Has anyone ever taught anyone how to drive? Yeah? I taught my wife how to drive. It's the surest road to divorce that there is, that's for sure. So for a new driver, when you first start driving, you're at the stage of conscious competence, which means you know how to drive, but you also realize that you're doing. You know what you know. What does that mean? I'm in a car, I'm going to switch lanes. Okay, I got it first, I got to turn on the left turn signal. I got to look over here. I got to go over into the lane. I got to look at my mirrors or check my mirrors. So that's the conscious competence stage, right? I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm cognizant of what I'm doing. But after we've been driving for a while, we get into the stage of unconscious competence. What does that mean? I get in the car, I get to work. And if you were to say, hey, look, was that light back there red or green or yellow? I would say, I honestly don't know. I was functioning on autopilot. I wasn't paying attention. When you walk into an organization and you start talking about enterprise project management, you've got people at different levels in this competency curve. You've got the people who are at the unconscious competence level, and I'm going to generalize here, but they're typically the people who've been around for so long that they know how to get things done. And if you say, hey, look, how do you manage your projects? They would go, I don't know. I just do it. You know, I fill out some form and it just magically happens. They probably do very good work, but they're not aware of what they're doing. You also have the people at the conscious incompetence level. And I would say people who just got their PMPs are at the conscious incompetence level, because I got my PMP and now I know what I should be doing, but I don't actually know how to do it in my organization. And then you've got the people at the conscious competence level who actually know what they're doing and they do it well. And the trick is to bring the people at the unconscious competence level down. You got to get them to make them aware or self-aware of what they're doing. And the other trick is that we need to work with our clients to bring them up to that conscious competence level. So that's part of how I structure an engagement. So when I walk in to do an engagement, I kind of keep all this in mind as I start talking to the various individuals within the engagement. All right. Question, sir?
What about the next level after that when you go to the executive level?
What about the next level?
Yeah, willful ignorance.
Willful, that's when we start talking about stupid organizations. Yes, so there's a question about executives and where they fall on that, and that's a whole nother question. All right, so let's talk about things we think we know. And this is key. So if you're looking for specific takeaways, I could probably throw some at you. This is going to be pretty high level. I'm just going to warn you right now. So the focus of an engagement oftentimes is the solution. This is wrong. Why? Because how many of you work in IT? Fair number of you. And so IT, right? What's a typical project server deployment in an IT department look like? It's resource management, right? We're going in there, we're going to list out all the projects, we're going to figure out the resources, figure out some workflow or something like that. And then we're going to match capacity against demand. You know, most IT departments are really not that different. It's rare that I walk into an IT department and it's not pretty much the same set of requirements. In fact, and I hate to say that, people have tried this, by the way, so there are business models around this. In fact, you could probably know very little about an IT department. I could come up with a full-blown solution for them, come in and say, hey, look, here's your solution. 2 weeks, do some training, give them my invoice, and run away as fast as I can. Why does that not work? Anyone? I heard something in the back. Yeah? It's not necessarily the solution to the problem. Could be. I will concede that. Although, again, with IT, it's always the same problem, typically. Or it often is the same problem. As much as IT departments like to think they're totally different from every other IT department, it almost always ends up being the same solution. Yes, sir? The organizational change, right? So what we're doing right there is we're ignoring the organizational change aspect of things. Now, the challenge with change is it's not derived from a solution. So if I come in there and I say, look, here's a solution, great. What I'm really doing is, and I've seen this happen in that consultant-client relationship, is the client becomes a victim. They say, this solution is something that was done unto me. I am the victim of it. I don't want to do it, and I'm going to blame that consultant. I always hear people start talking about, hey, that's Andrew's solution in the meetings. This comes up quite often. So the reality is that the focus becomes the problem. That I don't go into an IT department saying, look, here's the solution. I go into an IT department saying, hey, look, you tell me what your problem is, and they will probably tell me exactly the same problem that every other IT department has probably ever told me in all the prior engagements. But the goal really is not for me to understand their problem. The goal is for them to understand their problem. The goal is for them to have a consensus within the client group as to what their problem is, because that's the building block for organizational change, that there's a consensus amongst the group as to what the problem is. And I'll give you a list of recommended reading. But the trick is creating a shared problem space. And there's a number of techniques to create shared problem spaces. I'm not going to go into detail on that. There's a number of dialogue-based approaches. There are actually some tools out there, some open source tools in creating shared problem spaces. But again, the focus is the problem. So even if I were to come into an IT department that tells me they've got the same resource contention issues that the last IT department told me, I'm still going to sit down and I'm going to listen to what their problem is, because the mere fact that they're sitting there and telling me what the problem is helps us with the organizational change. Honestly, and I do pay attention, but the reality is I probably wouldn't even need to pay attention as long as we drive that conversation and we drive that consensus as to what the common problem is. Good. All right. So now that we've identified, we want to create this consensus as to what the problem is, there are two kinds of problems out there. There are the simple problems. So my problem is resource contention, give me a tool, fix it, go away. All right? And then there are problems that are wicked. How many of you have heard of wicked problems? I think it's a pretty common topic these days. What is a wicked problem? A wicked problem is a set of interrelated problems. In fact, it may not just be one problem. It might be 20 problems or 30 problems. You know, you start talking about world hunger. How do we fix it? Well, we grow more food. Well, if we grow more food, we destroy the land. Well, if we destroy the land, we don't have food. So anyways, there's this entire concept that every time we try to fix one problem, it creates these after effects. A wicked problem is part of a system. And there never is a solution to a wicked problem. It doesn't just go away. What we can do is assess what are the immediate problems. We can prioritize those, and we can work to alleviate those and try our bestest not to make the rest of the system worse. So deploying Project Server in an enterprise is a wicked problem. And we'll talk about techniques for doing analysis of the after effects and the impacts of deploying Project Server in an environment. Okay. Well, let's go back here. So the one key thing about wicked problems is that there's never really a steady state. You never really fix it. It's just an ongoing effort to continuously improve. All right, so great. So now let's talk about the concept of an organization. An organization inherently is a network of commitments. All right, it's people promising things to other people. That's what a PMO is. That's what project management is. And what we're doing in terms of improving project management maturity is we're rewiring these connections between people. We are encouraging people to think differently, to act differently, to create different sets of commitments with each other. So that takes us to our third issue, or the third thing that typically people think they know, but often is incorrect, and that is that the solution is technical in nature. The solution to enterprise project management maturity is almost never a technical solution. It is almost always adaptive in nature. What that means is that we create an initial solution, changes the state of the problem, we have a new problem or a different set of problem, or we reframe the problem, or we get closer to defining what the actual problem was in the first place. And we can then keep working with that and keep working to adapt the organization to a new way of thinking, to a new way of being. All right. So the solution is almost always adaptive. It's never, I'm going to go in here, I'm going to deploy a whole bunch of reports and move on with my life. In fact, reports are a classic example. I know how many of you, I know we had a couple who attended the BI presentation. So here's a typical scenario. Client calls me up, says, hey, look, we got a bunch of reports we want to automate. Right now we're doing some manual fashion. It takes 6 weeks to develop. Can you throw all the data in the project server and drop them into some reports, and our executives will look at it, and everyone will be happy? Oh, yeah, and it's got to show on an iPad, right? Okay. So we do 6 weeks of an engagement. We get all the data in one place. We put them all into some sort of report. We show the executive. Project is done, right? No, because what happens the minute the executive starts seeing those reports? Say again? Want something else? Which is good, right? Because what they're trying to do is make decisions. They're trying to make decisions based on data. Those reports support that decision-making process. A lot of times, people don't know what they want, or they don't know what problem they're trying to solve, and that's why we get into this iterative cycle, this adaptive iterative cycle. What that means is my goal, when I walk into that organization for 6 weeks, is not to create a bunch of reports. My goal is to build a capability within the organization such that they are able to build those reports. And that's a fundamental difference. So when you start looking at enterprise project management maturity and the relationship between a client and a vendor, and by the way, I don't think I would ever encourage anyone to try doing an enterprise project management deployment without a knowledgeable partner. And I'm going to say that, I'm going to kind of hedge that a bit. You know, the partner could be external, an external consulting agency, and obviously that's who I work for, so I am somewhat biased in this. Or it could be someone who has experience doing this in multiple organizations that maybe we've hired to do that, to play the role of an internal consultant, okay? But almost invariably, no organization has done this many, many times unless they are in a vendor sort of mode. All right. Great. So if we take these three premises, so we take a look at the first model, right? The focus is a solution, that the problem is simple, and that the solution is technical in nature, then what we can conclude is that we need a technical vendor to come in and produce a bunch of reports that's transactional. What this allows me to do as a client is to control the vendor, which is good, because let's face it, when I bring a consultant in, if I'm a manager and I bring a consultant in, a lot of times I'm ceding control to the vendor, and that's bad. I don't want to cede control. So what we do here is we create these boundaries, these technological boundaries. What we're also doing is we're limiting the value that the vendor can provide to us, because when we put them in this technological, and I'm going to use the word ghetto, I suppose, for lack of a better term, what we're doing is we're not looking at the problem space or creating a shared problem space. We're not out there trying to figure out what the organization wants. We're basically dictating what it is that the vendor will do, which is probably good for some vendors and some clients, but you're losing on the experience that the vendor brings to the table. So let's go to another model. In this model, the focus is the problem. So basically what we're doing is we're engaging a vendor to come in here and help us define that shared problem space. We accept that the problem is wicked, which means that there's never going to be a full-blown solution to this. This is going to be an ongoing effort to continually improve our project management maturity, and that the solution is adaptive. There is no steady state. That the minute we get to what we think is going to be the steady state, we're going to change it up because that affects how we view our problems. That moves us towards a more long-term trusting relationship. And again, I totally concede that, hey, look, I'm a vendor. This is what we're supposed to say, right? But at the end of the day, as a client, the client has control over this, right? A consultant is there to provide advice to consult. And they're supposed to provide honest advice. A manager's job is to take that advice and decide whether or not to follow it. That is the relationship between a manager and consultant. As long as that's honest, and that goes both ways, a consultant has to be honest as well, that can work. But when it's built off of concerns about control, what you end up is back in that first model, which says that it's transactional, that the vendor is basically there to provide a technological solution. And almost never is it a technological solution, especially project management maturity. I will concede that maybe, hey, look, you know, project server's broken. I need someone to come in and fix it, and they go off on their merry way. Great. That is a simple problem. That's a technical problem. That's great. But it's almost never the case when we're implementing enterprise project management tools. And I will say that you know, when everything's gone to the cloud, I will be so happy because it what it does is it removes the technological consideration from this entire thing and allows us as consultants to really focus on what we do best, which is really organizational development. And to be an enterprise project management consultant is really to work in the organizational development space, not the technology space, although we have to work in the technology space sometimes, again, just to get everything to work. So now let's talk about stupid organizations. What is a stupid organization? Everyone say, oh, well, am I working with? No. So the first thing I would say is PMOs are stupid. And I know, okay, I except for the PMOs, anyone in a PMO in this room, you're not. Everyone else, sure. And I'm not saying the concept of PMOs are stupid. I'm saying that PMOs often function from a position of organizational stupidity. And I'm not making this up. This is actually a concept that was introduced in a series of white papers. And organizational stupidity basically says, I can take the smartest people in the room, I can throw them together, have some great dialogues, and then be like, hey, that's not our focus. We're not going to focus on why projects happen. We're just going to focus on how to execute projects because we're the PMO and we do project execution. So functional stupidity organizational stupidity is really where we limit or we deliberately limit the role of the PMO, the role or the scope of the problem because of organizational constraints, okay? And I've got the links to all that. So if we accept that the focus is the problem is wicked and the solution is adaptive, what that means is that the problem exists as part of a system, right? A network of issues, a network of problems. So what I'd like to talk about right now are three approaches that I typically take when I start looking at where the problems lie and how they relate to the rest of the organization. So first off, I typically encourage everyone to do a functional analysis. Now, what is a functional analysis? We'll get into that in a second. I would say a value chain analysis is also important because a value chain analysis starts giving you the context for where you're going to go in terms of a long-term roadmap. Why do you need a long-term roadmap? Because the problem is adaptive, which means it's going to continue. We're going to continue over a cycle until we've reached a stage that we're happy with how things perform. And finally, operational integration. This is something that PMOs typically overlook. I know how many times I've heard a PMO say, hey, look, you know, we're just focusing on the project. After we do the project, we kick it to operations. It's not our problem. From an organizational standpoint, it is. It's a shared, it's a common problem. Great. So let's talk about functional analysis. So the trick to functional analysis is essentially to start with all your different project types. So in the project management world, right, we're talking EPTs. We start classifying, here's the different work management styles for projects. So I would start off saying I've got major projects, minor projects. And that, by the way, is a best practice, that almost always you're going to have some sort of degree of rigor that you're going to apply to your projects. You know, I can guarantee that you will fail if you try to apply the same level of rigor to all of the projects in your portfolio. It's pretty much guaranteed. All right. So you got major projects, minor projects, maybe I've got agile projects because there's that group over there that wants to do some sort of different methodology. Then I would plot out what that project life cycle looks like. And even if we're not going to implement workflow from day one, it is important to understand where projects come from and where they're going. And then we start identifying all the different functions that exist in the organization that suck or require information about that project. So that might be the annual planning process. Maybe I've got a project that lasts 2 or 3 years. Come June, that annual planning process is going to require the new estimates for next year. So we need to build that into our process, that we're building these estimates before annual planning requires it. Maybe release management is a separate function over here that needs to know when each project is going to be releasing. And I'm using IT examples, but the same thing applies to oil and gas, the same thing applies to physical infrastructure, new product development. The idea is that each of these are functions, resource management, resource managers, each of these are functions that require information from the project schedule or the project manager, right? So this is one form of analysis. And a lot of times the PMO focuses just on the project and not on these functions, which are typically external to the PMO. So that's one example. The second example is value chain. So I can't tell you how many times I come in and the PMO says, hey, look, we're just focusing on the project execution. Let's not worry about anything that comes before it. Let's not worry about anything that comes after it. So that's great. We can spend a lot of time on project execution, but I'll tell you, that is low value add. So if I come in here and we really work on a project execution, it's great. It's a need. But if you start working your way upstream in terms of where the project comes from, you're actually going to generate a whole lot more value for the organization. If we're doing the wrong projects the right way, we're still wasting money. Now, I'm not saying that I'm going to come in there and I'm going to say, hey, look, let's redo your entire portfolio management process. I don't think we can do that. And I think that, you know, part of this process of consulting is coming in there and building trust. And maybe that's where we need to start with execution. But at the same time, because this is an adaptive problem, we need to build that long-term viewpoint into it. So, hey, look, we got execution, we'll work on execution, great. What comes after that? Well, let's start focusing on project selection. Or, not just project selection, what about project sensing? This is something I talk about in a lot of my presentations. How do we know which projects to do? How do we have that sensing mechanism in place around the assets in our portfolio that says, hey, look, this asset is actually quite too expensive, we need to reduce cost, et cetera. And also, how do we realize the benefits from these projects? Right? This is a value chain. So that's just one example of something I would typically look at when I come in and I start looking at, you know, what the projects are. Typically, we would start in execution and work our way across, although there's also examples where you would start in the project selection and work your way down. Typically, that will generate a higher value much faster than any other way or any other approach. Okay, good. So here's also, this is a more typical issue I see. IT. Any project in IT typically is to create a new application or to upgrade an existing application or to retire an existing application. Is that a fair assessment? To modify an existing application with a couple new features. All right, so let's start off with, I'm gonna create and actually let's just take Project Server as an example. We're gonna do a project to implement Project Server. It's gonna take 3 to 6 months, right? That's your general bet for phase one of a project server deployment. Now the trick is, after those 3 to 6 months, we're going to have OpEx costs to support that project server. Where would those costs be coming from? Anyone? Wow, it is getting late in the day, isn't it? Say again? Yeah, so your infrastructure support, you know, if you're lucky and you've got a SharePoint team in-house, typically you take one of your SharePoint folks, you dragoon them over to the project server side of things. And from the application side, the PMO should have an owner. So on the business side, you actually have a business owner. So typically there's a team comprised of the business owner and the technical, right? And I would also, go ahead. Right, and they have competing values. And I would say this, though. The number one indicator of whether or not a project server deployment is going to succeed is, what's the support model look like? Because if I get to the end of my engagement and I say, great, you know, who's going to handle this going forward? And the answer is, well, we don't know. We haven't hired them yet. Then you can pretty much guarantee it's going to fail. If, on the other hand, we've got resources that are staffed from the get-go and they participate with me in the problem definition stage, and we have this kind of long-term viewpoint, then usually it's going to succeed. On the other hand, though, of course, once they get trained up, a lot of times they'll leave and go find a job somewhere else. I'm not looking at you, Nathan. But that's a typical issue. So again, what I would say is, focus on the support model. Why do we focus on the support model? Because it's an adaptive solution. Because you're never going to be done at 3 to 6 months. You're never going to be in quote-unquote steady state. Really, what we're doing is we're focusing on building that capability within the organization. Doesn't matter if we're talking project server, we're talking reports. It's the same concept. The focus is on building the capability to support the thing going forward, not so much focusing on the thing itself. Because if you got the capability, the thing is going to change, and it's going to change in an iterative fashion to better meet the needs of the organization. So we've got that OpEx expense, but in addition to that, any new application you drop into your infrastructure is going to have a CapEx expense for the every year after that as well. And that's going to be because functions will change, needs will change from the business. You're always going to be adding new features, new functionality, taking out old ones, modifying it. You might ratchet it down in a given year, just because we may not have a lot of changes, but usually what that means is you're just building up some technical debt. The following year, there's going to be a whole lot of pent-up demand for requirements and new stuff, and you're just going to have to spend more. So there's a typical model that says, for every application, I'm going to have OpEx and CapEx each year after I drop it into the infrastructure. And for every application next year, it's going to be the same, and it's going to be the same, and eventually I end up on this cost curve where the CapEx from today leads to the OpEx of tomorrow. And that's a key concept here. So if I'm a PMO and I'm doing projects, my projects typically are creating stuff. So there are some PMOs, of course, that are managing projects that are services we're delivering externally, in which case we're not dropping anything into our infrastructure. But I would say 90% of the people I work with are actually creating new stuff. On the other hand, going back to our concept, a lot of times the PMOs don't recognize that this is getting thrown over the fence. They don't pay attention. They're practicing organizational stupidity in terms of ignoring the OpEx costs. What does the organization care about? Does the organization care about the cost of a specific project? I'm going to say no. The organization cares about the cost of a specific asset, whether that asset be an application, a rig, a facility, something like that. And that cost includes both the cost to stand it up, to improve it, and to keep a steady state operations in that environment. So what that means is we need to integrate our projects with our operational work. How do we do that? We develop a common language with operations. And this is the high level stuff, and this, now I'm going to say this is the consulting thing here. One of the keys to being successful in enterprise project management maturity is developing a common taxonomy with the operations people. In IT, what does that mean? In IT, that means I can take every project and roll it up to an application. And on the operations side, I can take every ticket and work item and roll that up to an application. And even more important, I've got the same definition of applications on both sides of the fence. Because if they're defining an application over here some way differently, I'm never going to be able to get that data to merge. And if I can't get that data to merge, I can't report effectively on the cost of an asset. So the trick here is to really define a common language, a common roll-up of projects and operational work, which means going outside the PMO, working with other organizations. So what I see now is I think what I believe to be one of the more successful practices of organizations that are really integrating operations and projects is they tie it all back to enterprise architecture. And I'm not talking about necessarily IT enterprise architecture. I'm talking about assets, defining an asset structure that all the work ties back to, and defining a shared and common asset structure across both operations and projects. Great. So now we understand all this stuff, all these dynamics. How do we structure an engagement to ensure success, to ensure that we understand what it is we're trying to accomplish? So first off, if the focus is the problem, the first thing we want to do is stop talking about solutions. We go in there and we understand what the problem is. And again, it's not really my goal to understand what the problem is. It's my goal is for you to understand what your problem is, and then we can start working to solve it. The trick is, if you're talking about selling change management, you're pretty much halfway down the wrong path already. I shouldn't have to sell change management because change management is solving a problem that you told me you have. Right? If I'm selling change management, what I'm coming in and saying is, look, I got this great solution. It's better than what you got. You should buy it because it's better. The trick here is when you start trying to expand an initial implementation out to other business units. How many of you have done this? That you're working in a central core group, you've done a pilot, everyone agrees, this is how things are going to work. Now it's time to roll it out to that branch over there in, Europe. Has anyone ever tried to do something like that? And of course, typically what happens, we run into organizational change issues, such as what? I see you nodding. Pushback. Adoption issues. Why? Because again, we're doing the same thing. We're coming in there with a solution. Now, maybe the solution was defined by headquarters, and therefore they should use it. But again, we're basically falling back in the same rut. So what I like to do when I start pushing this out to other groups is we go out there and we start fresh. We say, hey, look, let's define what your problems are. Let's define your shared problems. 9 times out of 10, they're going to have the same problems that we solved back in headquarters. But what that does is creating that shared problem space enables us to actually implement the same solution for them, but we're not selling it, that we have accepted that this is now our problem and that we will now adopt it. You know, I would like to say that's the way it works perfectly. It's never the case. Now, what also happens is I'll get new feedback from that group that we can adopt into the overall solution and make it better. So when you start looking at how we expand out to other groups, what I would say is don't throw away the initial approach. That's what a lot of people do. Now, one trick to doing that, I might say, is to find people that are trusted throughout the organization, have them involved in that initial conversation, have them involved in defining that shared problem space. And if there's enough trust within the organization, when they go out and start proselytizing for the solution, they can much more effectively convince everyone that they do have a shared problem space. All right, great. So now, if the problem is wicked, which means there's a lot of moving parts, we don't necessarily agree on what the main problem is, there might be 12 problems all interrelated, we're dealing with a system, the trick there is not to rush to a solution, to do some analysis, to understand the context that we're working within, because context is everything in a project management environment or a project management deployment. And it's important to understand the enterprise architecture. And again, by enterprise architecture, I'm talking the overall taxonomy of the organization, talking the overall asset structure. This is critical if you want to integrate with other groups. If you don't want to integrate with other groups, great, that's fine. But on the other hand, there you might question, well, what is the value? If we're not going to provide the data that the organization really wants, if operations is going to provide this set of reports, and we're going to provide this set of reports, and I can't actually take those two reports and put them together, what's the point of the entire enterprise? At some point, you're going to run into that question. And honestly, I don't know how to answer it if I can't integrate that data. Finally, you actually have to pick partners that you trust to work with you. And if you don't trust your current partner, get rid of them. Go find a new one, honestly, which I know easier said than done. But that's kind of critical to have a long-term viewpoint at a wicked problem. All right, so solution is adaptive. If the solution is adaptive, that means we're going to be around, we're working on this for a long time. You have to plan for the long term. You're never going to be able to do this in 3 to 6 months. It's a 12-month, 17-month, 22-month, whatever your time frame is for planning. Now, that may not require a vendor to be there the entire time, but you do need to plan for that long term, and especially for organizations that do budgeting in the middle of the year, this is key. Because I can't tell you how many times we get to the end of the year and they say, man, we really need you or someone to stay here and support this going forward because we're still just kind of figuring out what we want to do. We're just getting our legs under us. Too bad we already missed the budget cycle. So plan around your budget cycle. Plan for that long-term engagement. Reject the myth of the steady state because you know what? You're never done. It's never going to be, hey, look, enterprise project management, we reached a maturity level. We're not going to make any more changes ever. That never happens pretty much with any application out there in the world. That also governs our approach because what we want to do with our approach is make it as flexible as possible, which means we try not to lock ourselves down in options. From a technical standpoint, what does that mean? Avoid customization like the plague. Customization is bad. Sometimes you have to do it. And you know, we do it. We've got our developers. We'll do all the customization in the world. But the first thing I would always tell you is, let's see if we can come up with a way that avoids customization entirely. Because once you do that, it starts locking you in. You can be less adaptive, less flexible to the needs of the organization. And this is key here, avoid over-engineering. I can't tell you how many times I see this. When you know, when you're over-engineering, when you're spending time figuring out all the details of some sort of workflow that you know no one's ever going to do, and it's only going to be an exception process, and 1% of all the projects are going to follow, stop, because what you're doing is you're introducing complexity into the system, and you don't need to. One of the typical ways of over-engineering, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard this, and this may resonate around the crowd, you know, project server's great, sites look great, it just can't look like SharePoint. Right? Okay, maybe previous versions of SharePoint were a little uglier, I will grant you that. But when you start going from that mentality from the get-go, what that means is I've got to spend a lot of time customizing and putting code in that's really not required. It locks me into a solution. So avoid over-engineering the solution, and you'll be in good shape. So what we covered today, and it's a very quiet group, so open for questions here. So what we covered today is things we think we know. Now, what did we talk about there? We talked about how the fact that oftentimes deploying an enterprise project management tool is not a simple endeavor. It's not a technical endeavor, and it's not really a short-term endeavor. We talked about stupid organizations. What are stupid organizations? Organizations that ignore the overall system that we work within, the context that we work within. And then we talked about a couple ways of structuring for success, which is how do you structure your overall engagement? And the main thing I would give you from there is to really focus on the problem and not the solution, and two, to focus on building capabilities and not solutions again. Yeah, because what we're doing is really we want to build a capability within the organization. And that's pretty much all I got. I've got some further reading, so if you're interested in any of this, these are some great books. If you're in IT, I would recommend the top one. If you're not in IT, don't worry about it. But it's definitely a great book on enterprise architecture, how to work with consultants, and also how to create problem spaces. That last book I would call out, Paul Comcy is actually quite active in the SharePoint community. So he took a lot of what he's done in terms of SharePoint adoption and turned it into how do you create these shared problem spaces and how do you frame wicked problems. It's actually a great book. It's worth reading. And my contact information. So you're all free to go. Any questions, or can we talk about more specifics? I could start throwing out some technical nuggets if that's what you came for. How are we doing? late in the day. Right. So let me. So it's important to understand why we want to customize before we just jump into. Right. So the goal is to understand what they're trying to do. Right. So from a. To give you an example, by the way, from reporting, where Microsoft has really come in now is that you can do a lot of reporting in Excel. Right? So before I start going customization, I start developing SSRS reports, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll gin up the reports in Excel. And you know, I'll call them prototypes, but the reality is they're working reports and they're having all the valid data. They just may not be as clickable. And oftentimes I'll try to say, hey, look, you know, this is probably the best solution for now. And then that also gives us the adaptability that we can change things until we get to the point that we kind of identified what the organization wants. Right. So it's also important to talk about the consequences. And, you know, some of those books talk about, you know, the trick to being a good consultant, and I know there's half the room is about consultants, the trick to being a good consultant is being honest. So if your client is asking you to do stupid things, your job as a consultant is to say, hey, look, that makes me uncomfortable. In fact, that was, it's kind of funny because after reading that book, I started making more emotional statements to my client. That was my goal for a couple months was, to express my emotions to my clients. And of course, they started laughing at me and it gave me a total complex. But really, that's what I should be doing. And again, as a consultant, my job is to give advice. Their job is to take the advice and use it or not, right? So great. Right. So scope management's key. All right, any other comments? Yes, sir. Right. So the, you know, what happens when, and I'll just repeat for the recording, right? So what happens when a client says, hey, look, we just want you to come in, do a technical implementation, and go away, right? Essentially. And the trick there is, it's again, as a consultant, it's my job to provide advice, and my typical response is, look, you're going to fail. So you're basically wasting your money for 3 months of a consultant. You're going to get a solution that no one's going to be around to support. And you will have no user adoption. The worst thing I ever hear when I come in and I say, hey, look, what kind of reports do we want? And the response is, well, I don't know, you tell us kind of what reports you do for other clients and we'll just take those standard set of reports. Again, what that's doing is that's pushing me back into the role of foisting a solution off on you. And you know, I'll say, hey, look, you know, I really don't want to do this, I'm not comfortable with this. No, you just give us whatever reports you want. I'll do those reports. I give them off. 3 months later, sure enough, hey, you know, we don't really like those reports that Andrew gave us. We're not actually using them. We didn't really think we got any value out of them. Of course they didn't get any value out of them because we never really understood why we were doing them in the first place and what the problems were. But that's pretty common. That's a common scenario. Yes, sir. So what are the best practices to managing change around expanding the value chain? That's a tough question. And the real answer is talking to the right people. Because a lot of times project selection happens outside of the PMO. So if I'm talking to the PMO about project selection, I'm talking to the wrong people. A lot of times the problem derives from the executives. I think we talked about that when we were talking about epistemology and conscious incompetence and everything, that a lot of times it's really at the executive level that you need to be talking about moving up the value chain. Not always, but that's typically the case. Now, there are cases made. You know, there's bottom-up change versus top-down change. And what I find is that the more the people at the bottom agree on what the common problem is, the easier it is to convince the organization that that's the problem. Meaning, if it's just me coming in here saying, hey, look, your project selection mechanism is all wrong, no one's going to buy into that. But if the entire group that I work with in the PMO is saying that, then that gives a lot more credibility to the argument. And that's typically kind of the approach I would take in terms of managing change at that level. But there's other models where you come in because the executive has decided that there is an issue with project selection, and they bring you in purposely to start there. And I'll tell you, though, you're going to get the most value quickest and for the cheapest dollar value, I guess, if you start at the top of that value chain. Pretty much guaranteed. All right. Yes, sir. Mike. Which slide? Which one? Oh, that one. Sorry. Go in there. All right. Great. Any other comments, questions, concerns? Then go forth and drink at the House of Blues. Thank you all for coming. You've been a great audience, especially for this late in the day. Thank you.